Hi, and welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show.
You're an ultra endurance athlete and you're also a powerlifter, but for so many of us, we've been told for so long, you can't do two things at once. You can't train for hypertrophy or strength gains and also cardio endurance. But your testament that that's not true. Can you kind of set the record straight? Is it possible to do two things at once?
Yeah. So I think that for the longest time, the industry really bucketed everyone as you either do cardio or you only do strength training. And I think that, you know, I have to, you know, disclaim this because there's definitely people who are going to get all worked up and be like, well, this, and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, when we look at the elite extremes of fitness, yes, of course, there's going to have to be some specific specialization. But generally, even at those elite extremes, like strength athletes generally are doing some sort or should do some sort of cardiovascular training in their fitness for general health and physical preparedness. And strength athletes are generally doing, endurance athletes are generally doing some sort of strength training to complement the work that they're doing, even if that's just for maintaining like physical health and strength and just injury prevention or reduction or whatever that is there. And so I think everyone thinks about like, well, you need to do the thing to do the thing. And that is true. Specificity does apply. But I think we've really overstated the amount or volume or proficiency of certain areas that you have to be in before you kind of stop making benefits in both things at once. And so for most general people, first of all, everyone should be doing some form of resistance training and cardiovascular training from just a bare minimum health standpoint. When we think about like what is the most effective thing to do for health, it's starting there. Yes. But then when we build from that, people can make progress in both of these things for quite a long time before, you know, more specificity would be required to master something or a sport or whatever that looks like for X, Y, or Z. Or like something I like to take is like this seasons approach where like, yeah, maybe you do have periods of time where you're more specifically dialed in on this specific goal versus this other specific goal. But the goal across time with like hybrid or concurrent training, which is trendy right now, is to improve your capacity to handle and do both over time. And so people try to think of it as, okay, well, if you're doing both, well, you're not as strong of a lifter and you're not as good of a runner, but you don't need to be thinking of it as that as much as you need to be thinking about how good are you at doing both? Like, what is your strength and endurance capacity simultaneously? And so when I think about this, there's a spectrum that people fall on where you're either pure endurance and pure strength, and maybe you don't do any cardio or any strength or any complementary work. And you probably should, especially if you're not competitive or elite or regular person. And then you take a step in and you have like, I'm a runner, but I do some strength training to support red training. And then you have, I'm a lifter, but I do some cardio just to support health and performance. And then you have that middle ground of people who are really trying to maximize both at the same time. So you really, first of all, have to think about your priorities of where you're at and what that looks like. And so for my background, I grew up running, a field sport athlete. I quit halfway through college on my lacrosse team. I got really into strength training. I did a strongman and some powerlifting meets and a little bit of Olympic weightlifting and dabbled in some CrossFit and all these things. And so for me, what ended up happening is I kind of got drink too much of the Kool-Aid. My VO2 max tanked. I lost aerobic fitness. I could barely run 2 miles. I felt like crap. And I had always grown up being and feeling very athletic and overall well-rounded and prepared. And I hated that. So I started to add back in the cardio. And for me, being an exercise physiologist, it was like this big experimentation of like, well, how can you do both? And where can you do both? And balancing the two things and marrying those two things that I really love together within my fitness. And this was before everything was trendy, but you had the rise of CrossFit, which is kind of probably the first model of concurrent training. And you're seeing these people who are incredibly fit, who do have high levels of strength and high levels of endurance capacity. And you could even argue that in the field of CrossFit athletes, you know, you can look at different athletes that are more specialized in strength versus endurance, but the capacity to do both simultaneously is true in all of them. And the people who are the best and the most elite there are ones who can kind of handle a little bit of everything, that specialization of that. But then we've kind of seen this with even the rise of like the obstacle course racing and now HYROX and the hybrid trend that's going around now. And a lot of people are kind of, this is the thing, this is the movement, this is the thing that's going on right now. And it's kind of challenging this belief that everyone has, well, if you want to be strong, you have to be strong. And if you want to be in, you know, cardiovascularly fit, you have to only do that. And there is some truth to that, but we can improve them both simultaneously, whether that's doing them both at the same time, or again, taking that like stepwise seasons approach that I think is a little bit more effective of like, hey, you are a little bit more leaning on cardio here because you suck at cardio and you need to improve your cardio and you've been only strength training. So you need to kind of dive in and specialize in that a little bit more for a while, but we're maintaining or still progressing maybe slower the strength thing, or hey, you know what? I have a really great aerobic engine. I don't have any strength training history and capacity. Yes, you're going to have to strength train and do hypertrophy work and spend a lot of time dedicated to improving that thing. And I think that's where a lot of people are starting to question the hybrid thing, because a lot of people are coming into the sphere, come from backgrounds like me, where we spent years and years and years strength training and gaining muscle. And it's a lot easier to maintain those things once you have them versus, you know, develop them when you already have an established only, you're very thin, lean, endurance-based athlete, it might be hard to add that in. And then vice versa, right? The meatheads feel like, okay, well, I'm not making any cardio progress because they're unwilling to let go some of that strength to develop that cardio. And it's about kind of figuring out where that, I hate the word balance, but it does work in the situation, like where that balance is for you and where you need to strike it in order to like raise the base on both of these things over time. It's not about just pushing both to their max all the time. It's about intentionally curating fitness in different areas. And while you're specializing in one or pushing one or refining one, not letting the other fall the wayside. Because a lot of people make the mistake of they'll be like, well, I'm going to train for a race and I'm going to drop off lifting. Then I'm going to strength train and I'm going to drop off running. And they're never making this and performance improvement in both at the same time. So when we really want to think about doing both at the same time, for most gen pop regular people, they don't need this as much as of a specialized approach if they're just doing it for general health and fitness. You can just do both and you'll get better at both and it's going to be fine. But then if you want to be like that kind of middle ground where you're maximizing both, kind of where I live, you do have to be a little bit more specific and more intentional about how we're thinking and approaching about this, because it's kind of periodization within the program between these two different variables, which is called concurrent training in the literature. And athletes for years and years have done this, which I think is so funny that people are so adamantly against hybrid or concurrent training. They're like, it doesn't work. And I'm like, everyone except for elite marathoners and elite like weightlifters generally aren't like those types of athletes have some sort of blend of conditioning and strength to let them perform well at the sport that they do, like basketball players and football players and a lot in like soccer players, like a lot of these athletes have a good blend of these two things in order to be able to perform their sport or support their sport. So it's not super crazy if you come from a background of strength and conditioning or athletics, but it's really foreign to the fitness community where it's like you either get to be a marathoner or you get to be a bodybuilder. And like that's the only two options that you get. And anything that strays from that norm doesn't make sense and it doesn't work. And, you know, I think what often happens too is that people end up not performing as well or having as much fitness as they could in those other specific domains because they neglect all these other components of general fitness and physical preparedness. So all that to say is, yes, you can make progress in both simultaneously for a very long time. The more fit you become, the more specific and intentional you'll have to be with this. And there might be a breaking point of where, yeah, you do have to specialize a little bit more in one area in order to maximize your potential in that area, whether that's temporarily or you're preparing for a competition or you are elite to some degree. But even athletes at the professional level or even like high school, college, whatever, they go through seasons of training. And that's why I really like to take that approach here as well. So yes, you can make progress in both unless maybe you're trying to be in that 1% of the population.
Can you paint me a picture of what your seasons approach would look like for somebody who wanted to do, as you said, get better in both strength areas and in cardio? So I think what happens for most people, they fall in one of two camps. They prioritize their cardio and their strength drops off, or vice versa. They'll work on strength and their cardio disappears. Or you'll have someone who thinks, you know, the cardio is going to kill my gains, so I'm not going to go for a run. But then it's been a couple of weeks since I've been for a gym session, but I don't do cardio because I'm going to lose what little gains I have. And they end up doing nothing. And that's the other end of the spectrum. From your seasons approach, how can someone begin to instigate that? Is it a 12-month periodization block? Paint me a picture of how you actually see it working for Gen Pop.
So you can think of it in terms of a year. You can think of it in terms of a year and a half, 2 years. The thing about hybrid training that I think a lot of people have to think about is like with just strength training or just endurance training, it makes sense. It's linear. I'm going to keep pushing this thing to get better. Where with hybrid training, you're going to have to think about like, okay, here's where I'm at now, and here's where I can be in a year. And you're kind of taking, like, you have these two steps. You have the endurance step and the strength step or muscle step or whatever it is. And you're kind of like taking this stepwise increase of each of those at the same time. And so I have this thing I like to call like the hybrid pyramid. So the base is just like your general aerobic fitness and then your general like strength capacity, your skill, your ability to move weight or move under a barbell or just lift weight, and just like the general base of like having some sort of baseline of cardiovascular fitness and having some sort of baseline of just like strength and or strength experience. And then from there, you're refining it. Okay, then we're building volume, adding an intensity, and each of these maybe becoming more technical in our lifting, more specific in our running training. And then from there, when you have this good base of like your baseline fitness, a little bit more refined, you can add a little bit more, handle more volume, handle more intensity. Then from there, we can kind of, you know, again, take another step in that intensity, working out higher intensities, higher work outputs, higher efforts, or handle more of both at the same time. And then that's where we can kind of master that hybrid training, because what you're trying to do is raise the floor of what you're capable of doing when you're thinking of hybrid training. And the way you do that is you have to look at your base. Where are you lacking? So for many people, they're like, okay, well, it's like me when I was coming out of powerlifting and strength training, like I significantly lacked an aerobic base and aerobic fitness. So what I needed in that point in time was to take a season of time where I was extremely dedicated to building and developing my aerobic fitness and strength. And for people, depending on how much you're lacking in certain areas, that might be a process that is 12 to 24 months to do that. And so you don't want to just give up lifting the entire time that you're doing that, because that takes time. But it's going to be probably the most uncomfortable in that first like 3 to 6 months when you're developing that baseline of fitness that you need to build upon. And that's where I think most people give up, because it's more fatiguing, it's more demanding. And so your strength or your gym work will be more impacted because you're trying to manage this overall increase in volume and fatigue. And so what people need to be doing when they're adding in that one thing that they are less proficient at is pulling back the volume, or like I really like to think of like if you're adding in cardio to lifting, pulling back the volume and keeping the quality. So keep your intensity high, keep your weights high. People make the mistake of just lifting light for like a lot of reps. Keep it more strength focused, more quality, more strength, and or lower end of that hypertrophies type spectrum stuff. Keep your intensity and quality up. You can reduce on either end of the spectrum your volume overall in whatever area you're trying to maintain, but like 30% and still maintain or make progress. Or I think people realize that like sometimes you can make progress with less because you're able to recover more when you start adding these things. So that's where like if you're coming from the strength side of things, adding that in, pulling it back, lifting, keeping it more quality. I think a lot of people cling to like the 5-6 days a week of lifting coming from the bodybuilding world, and they're so hesitant to lean towards maybe like 3 full body days or a full upper, like a 4-day upper lower split, or 2 full body days, even depending on the volume or what they can handle in their week of training, and realizing that like less of quality might be helpful to pull back so you can make space for the time and or physiological demands of building up that cardio base. But then the goal long term would be once you start to get more of that base and you could tolerate more and handle more of the cardio, then you kind of maintain that cardio and you bring your lifting kind of back up, or you inch it back up, because then your floor is raised and you can handle more. So then you could go into a season if you wanted to of really pushing your strength again and building up strength and muscle, but then maintaining that cardio of where you've been at. And then you can bring that up again, just depending on how far you're wanting to push your fitness. And on the contrary, for the endurance junkies, cardio bunnies, cardio lovers, a lot of them have no muscle or strength or proficiency there. And so they have the similar but opposite. They might need to spend a year or two really pulling back on the racing and the high volume running. And that doesn't mean giving up running. It just means like maybe you're not running 60 miles a week. Maybe you're running 30 miles a week or something like that. It's still like, you know, that's just an example of that. Just depending on the person, everyone's different. Some people are runners, but they run 10 miles a week. Some are runners and they're running a bajillion miles a week. But you might need to pull back a little bit to make time and space to add in that baseline of strength and like familiarity and skill, because lifting is a skill too, right? And building that up so then you're less fatigued and less sore over time. And then, okay, you have this good strength base that you can pull from and good muscle base or whatever it is. And it's going to be easier to maintain because it's up here. And then you can bring your cardio back up and either go through a season where maybe you're pushing towards a marathon or a big racing goal or whatever that looks like. And it's all about basically titrating those steps, but balancing not just your physiological resources, because it's people they make those mistake often of like, okay, my lifting's at 100% here, but I want to start adding in cardio. So I'm going to add cardio in at 100%. And what they need to do is pull their lifting down to 80% and pull their cardio up to 20% because they only have under 100% capacity if that's what they're doing. Or like pull lifting down to 50% and put 50%. Like you have only 100% of yourself to give. But what happens all the time with hybrid training is you have this bucket of capacity, I like to call it, and you get more water in your bucket. So then you have more to give into each of these domains. And so when we think of the seasons approach, it doesn't have to be as concrete as like every quarter of the year you're doing something, but it's just about dedicating a specific period of time to certain things. So I have like what I have built this more in the phrase of like people who are race training and prepping, but that's not always true for people. But I like to think about in like a classic like sport training season, you have preseason, you have the season, you have off season, and then you have like the pre-preseason base recovery type stuff that you're doing there. So when you're thinking about that, you're going through seasons of what I like to call strength building seasons. You're more focused on building strength and muscle in gym. Your lifting days, your volume, your intensity goes up a little bit and your running or cardio volume goes back a little bit. But the goal is to keep it at the volume of which you want to maintain at the least for whatever your long-term goals are. I think a lot of people make the mistake of like, hey, I like to run marathons and ultra marathons, but I'm going to drop to 5 miles a week of running. That's not what you want to do. You still want to maintain a decent base, but you want to find that happy medium of where you can maintain it, that it's not, it's still like, you're still able to handle that volume and recover from it. And it's hard to give a concrete answer because for every person, that's different. I can maintain a half marathon level fitness in my off season now, where in the beginning, people might only be able to maintain like a 5K level fitness or whatever that looks like. It's really going to be, again, based on how much you personally can handle, and that should increase, or it can increase if you wanted to over time. And so I have that strength focus season where that's your main priority, that's your main goal. The percentage of your efforts and time towards strength will shift up a little bit. And then I have like the base building or pre-race prep or pre like kind of, this is like what you would think of as your true kind of hybrid season. You're kind of balancing a good ebb and flow of both endurance training and resistance training. And I actually really like a long version of this phase. I think it's a great time where you can build a lot of aerobic fitness by just maintaining like a good base build base of aerobic fitness while still pushing strength and kind of making progress simultaneously, because you're never overloading one. You're kind of, it's kind of almost like if people like eat at maintenance in their dieting phase, like you're not bulking or cutting rapidly, but you're kind of titrating this effort at the same time. And I think if we don't rush these phases, you can actually gain a lot of simultaneous fitness in this. And then you can move into like a race prep in peak, or in that case, that could be like an endurance like focused block of training if you're not racing, peaking and training, where, okay, the lifting is going to be pulled back. You're still keeping it in and keeping the quality where you can. Maybe you're doing less days or they're shorter, but you're kind of overloading that aerobic fitness or that endurance training that you're doing there. And then you have the recovery. So in the recovery, you're kind of taking a break from the endurance training, and I like reverse tapering back in your strength to build into that next strength phase or an extended version of the running phase if that's what you're in. And so that's how I like to think of those things, because you're kind of titrating them, but there's never, you know, the only phase that's going to be really kind of a specific set amount of time is like if you're peaking and prepping for a race, that's usually the 6 to 12 weeks leading into it. And I think a lot of people get worried about during that period of time of like letting go of that. But if you're really overloading your training there, that's intentionally to gain a lot of fitness. You're having to get a little bit more specific on that goal of endurance training. But the goal is to maintain. You're not necessarily trying to make significant progress in your lifting. You're just trying to maintain your muscularity and lifting capacity kind of where it's at while you're doing that. So you can make space in your physiological capacity and recovery to really dial in on that goal. But then the off season, it's kind of that antagonist of that. And so where people need to be in these really kind of depends on, again, who they're at and where they're at. The runner who's always been a runner might need a really strong, hefty strength season. And the lifter who's always been a lifter might need a really heavy, strong, hefty cardiovascular season in training. And so if it depends on how detrained you are and where you're at, but I really like this almost as like a year cycle for people who are running training. If it can fit into a year, if you have a baseline, it's the people who are really lacking in one or the other who might be like, hey, you know what? I need to suck it up and spend a year really dedicated to this one thing so that I have that second half of my base, because you can't build a pyramid on only half of the side, right? So you need to kind of figure out where you're at, what you're missing. So that's how I like to think of the seasons approach. And it's all about titrating like what you can do and where you can shift things. But then over time, your 100% should increase. So I think that's where people get really hung up on it. They're like, well, you're telling me to do less of each. And I'm like, well, you're doing less of each because you're doing both. But the goal over time is that you can handle more of both. Like that high volume becomes earned. And even if you could do, say, 5 hours a week of lifting before, but you were doing 0 hours of cardio at all, well, you're not going to be able to do 5 hours lifting and add 3 hours of cardio. You're probably going to have to pull down lifting to like 3 hours of lifting and put up the cardio and increase that so you can kind of adapt and handle that. And if you can get through that phase where you feel like, okay, cardio is killing my gains, my strength performance is decreasing, I'm losing everything, it's just fatigue masking performance. Same thing with running. Runners hate adding and lifting because it makes their legs sore and they run slower and they feel fatigued and they just don't give themselves enough consistency where that fatigue or that interference or that soreness goes away because you're used to the stimulus. And that's where people kind of lose their chance at really developing this. You kind of really have to commit to the bit here for an extended period of time to really be able to handle both. And I think the reason that it's so much more unsexy than just strength training or just cardio training is it is a little bit of a slower process because you're kind of building and maintaining as you go. And that's why I really like to encourage people thinking like multi-year things. So an example would be, I spent a big strength training season. I did a ton of ultras, focusing on that for a really long period of time in the middle of my PhD. Did a very heavy, hard strength training season. I was also recovering from an injury and finishing my PhD. So I did lose a little bit more fitness than I would have liked at that time, but it was just kind of situational and I did what I could. And then I shifted into a really long period of time of rebuilding back my aerobic fitness. But I kind of went into a really long period of time of like, I had a good base of strength and I knew what I could handle. And I pulled that back a little bit and really it let that cardio increase. But then I just maintained. I've been doing a lot more of these long maintenance seasons in my early phases of training because I've been doing fall races where I'm spending like my January through like May or June, like in this base build phase where I'm able to still really push strength as I just maintain my running and let that kind of area under the curve of my aerobic fitness develop. I think a lot of people make the mistake of thinking running or cardio training is just increasing it linearly rather than finding a good base to maintain at and letting that repetitive stimulus and improvements in performance there drive that if it's at a high enough kind of level. And so I really like that for people who are a little bit proficient in each or refining those things, but it's all about just like figuring out like, you know, really for most people, the honest answer is what do you hate doing and what do you suck at? Go spend 6 to 12 months focused on that and then go from there.
Turning to women's specific training and away from performance, more for women who want to train for general health, well-being, longevity. A number of experts I've spoken to have said when it comes to cardio training, a lot of women tend to focus too much on the high intensity and not enough on the volume. And then conversely, when it comes to the strength training, there's too much focus on volume and not enough on intensity. Does that echo with your experience of working with female clients? And if so, what are the implications of taking that approach of getting not a mixed intensity versus volume equation?
Yeah. So I think that the unfortunate reality for, and I'm sure males deal with their own versions of this, but I think that there's too much influence of like dieting fitness exercise advice for women. And then that gets applied to their performance advice. So they're chasing intensity or volume or overdoing it all the time because they feel like, at least in the types of people who tend to do that. So there's two types of camps. The people who are doing so little exercise volume, it doesn't really matter because whatever they're doing is whatever they're doing. And it might not be the best and most proficient for what they want to do. But also like they're not really doing enough anyway that it's like that's great for health. And then there's the people who have specific goals or specific outcomes or performance things they want, but they're just burning the candle at both ends. They're doing like they want to do a million days of lifting and they want to do cardio on those days. They want to do all the cardio and they want it to all be hit in speed workout and high volume lifting and lots of reps and sets and circuit training and like boot campy type stuff and go, go, go. And so there is this lack of appropriate balance between the high intensity and the low intensity cardio. And the quality lifting versus just like a bajillion reps of lifting. And so I do see this a lot in some subsets of clients and women that I work with where they just want to feel the burn and whatever it is that they're doing all the time because that's associated with I did enough work or it was good or it was enough or like I'm burning more calories or I'm burning fat or if I don't let go of this intensity, then it's not worth it and it's not quality and I'm not making progress, just whatever their head game is, whether it's related to their body or their performance or whatever that is. And so, yeah, I do agree that I think that women tend to do this like multiple day a week, moderate to high intensity type cardio stuff all the time, the group fitness, the boot campy, always doing speed and high intensities. And there is some truth that women might be able to handle or need a little bit more of their overall ratio coming from intensity to some degree, but not 80 to 90% of it, which is what a lot of them are doing. And then with the lifting, they're doing a lot of like high rep, underloaded or not heavy enough loaded strength training and doing a lot of volume, a lot of reps, a lot of sets, but they're never loading it to a high enough percentage of their one rep max or training those strength ranges or kind of shifting their training to being like more quality, higher exertion, lower volume, but you're getting almost more out of it and letting go of that feeling of doing more work is better. And so I think that, yeah, there is like, if we're thinking about performance or even like a lot of women have body composition goals or body change goals. And to some degree, a lot of what supports that is performance focused training. It's not just the burning the candle at both ends that is sold to them by the industry. And so, yeah, I think that if we can get a little bit more of the easier recoverable stuff to actually like accumulate volume and gain fitness and or, hey, let's pull back all the junk volume and extra reps that we're doing in the gym and actually just increase the weight of what we're doing. So the sets that we are doing, we're getting more out of. So we're not just always doing more, more, more. We'd see a lot more progress, especially in that population. And that's not a physiological thing. That's just more of a psychosocial cultural thing that's influencing the way we train rather than like hormones or physiology or any of that stuff.
I was going to say, it's almost as though, I think this applies to both men as well. If you do a HIIT session, you really feel it in the short, you know you've done it. Whereas if you go and do zone two for an hour and a half, you barely break a sweat. Likewise, if you're doing a lot of reps in the gym, you're going to get that burn, you're going to get a pump. Whereas if you're doing an intense session, again, you might not sweat, you might not feel like you've done anything. Is this kind of more of a, maybe a lack of general knowledge about how training works? And, yeah. And it feels like if we don't get that, we don't have that short-term intense feeling of training, then it wasn't worth it, even though you can't see the bigger picture.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, right now we're coming kind of out of this hyper swing of like what the late 2000s into the 2010s, where everything was intensity and push it and effort and like no sweat, like, well, you know, all those cliche sayings and things, I can't even think of them off the mic, that you might pin on your Pinterest page. Like basically like no pain, no gain.
No pain, no gain.
Yeah, like that kind of mentality. And there's been a hyper swing, I think, too, on the contrary of this, at least in the female space, of like only do low intensity. Don't do any volume. Don't do any intensity. No HIIT, no this and that, no heavy lifting, like just walking and easy, low intensity stuff. And that's just an inappropriate hyper swing. But I think that so many people, because of that, and a lot of that comes from the diet industry of like push yourself, fat loss. And it's like sometimes just counter to like what people need to be doing to appropriately make progress in their fitness that indirectly ends up supporting those goals anyway, is that they feel like, well, if I didn't feel it and it didn't hurt and I didn't hate it, then it wasn't working. It wasn't worth it. So I think people have this perception of like fitness has to always be painful or difficult or uncomfortable to be actually worth doing. And then you see zone two or even like, you know, higher quality lifting where it's like heavy weights, but you're not like doing so many sets and reps that you're totally toasted. You're not making your lifting cardio. Not to say heavy lifting is hard in its own degree, but like sometimes like my training sessions, especially when I'm really pushing and prepping for running and racing, I don't want my lifting to bleed all this incredible fatigue into my running training. So I'm doing a lot of athletic stuff, like more plyometrics and more like lower rep, heavier stuff with rest between and less overall stuff. And I don't feel wrecked after my lifts like I might in a more strength focused season, but that doesn't mean it's not working or not doing anything. And it doesn't need to always be, you know, I think people perceive the quality of the workout coming from the sweat and the breathing rate of what they're doing. More strength training for people who are more like obsessed with that feeling. It's hard, but it's hard for like 3 seconds in the middle of the set and then it's not so bad, right? Kind of thing. Or they're not loading it enough to really feel how hard it can be in its own special way. And yeah, so I think it's just this social perception of people who grew up with P90X and then the Orange Theory boom and now the CrossFit boom. And, you know, all those things can be fine in their own regards. But yeah, I think people have this perception that if it isn't the most high, intense, hard, difficult thing in the world, then it wasn't worth your doing. And I think it is a lack of knowledge. But even people I see, they struggle with like the zone two thing, right? Because I've been kind of known for the zone two thing. And trust me, I'm the queen of zone two training because that's all ultra marathon training is. It's like, I mean, you do a little bit of quality stuff, but a lot of it is just you're going really slow and easy to accrue volume. And so, you know, I think people, when they start doing it, they're like, this isn't enough or this isn't good. And it takes them kind of just trusting it long enough to see it work to buy in. But they don't trust it until they see, oh, wait, I can do this and I'm not dying and I feel good and I'm making progress. And so like it almost they have to like stick with it long enough to actually trust it. And even then, sometimes they're like, well, we see this with clients all the time. Well, I want more. I need more. I need to add some metcons. I need to add some hit. I need to do this. And I'm like, but you don't. Like, one day a week or 2 days a week, that's totally fine. But you don't need 6 days of this on top of your running, that zone two, for it to be worthwhile while doing the heaviest volume lifting plan. What you need is to probably pull back the lifting if you want to add in that intensity and cardio so you have more space in your week, but you don't need a bajillion days of it. You need to either say, hey, I want to focus on just this type of training, or I need to develop this, but you still have to manage that volume and that intensity. But I think people don't realize, one, that it works, because also the unfortunate reality of lower effort training is that it takes longer for people to, I feel like, to see the results from it, because zone two or the easy cardio training specifically, that's a process for you to start seeing adaptation and progress from that. Sometimes for some people it can take up like months, like 3, 6, 12 months of working on that to see it finally working. And so they're like, well, screw it. Why would I do this if I could just, my heart rate's high anyway, so I might as well just be intense. And it's not the same thing, but like there's this frustration between feeling like you're not doing enough while also feeling like it's not working. And it's hard.
And also, yeah. I think sometimes it can be counterintuitive. The research between increasing your VO2 max in zone two training to the average person, you think, well, if I want to increase my VO2 max, I need to be pushing it all the time. Whereas actually all of that zone two training is building that foundation, bringing all the baseline up. And I think the counterintuitive aspect is something people combined with long-term results, it feels like, oh, it's too much. It doesn't work. I don't trust the process.
Yeah. And I think the reality too, for people that sucks for them too, is the point of it is so you can do a lot more volume, and people don't have the time or bandwidth or desire to do higher volume. They don't want to do 60 minutes of zone two. They want to do 15 minutes of HIIT and be done for the day. And I get that desire, but yeah, they don't realize that. Yes. Well, the HIIT training in those VO2 quality efforts are driving your VO2 max. Yes, that's important. But that easy training is building all of the machinery, right? Like it's like, you know, it's like basically building out a whole car. So that you have the equipment that you need to be able to accelerate, right? But they just want the acceleration from the training and HIIT and high intensity stuff. Yeah. For a lot of people, especially if you're low fitness or low training, that will take you decently far. But at some point you can't just HIIT your way to developing this huge baseline of aerobic fitness and mitochondrial capacity and capillary density and oxygen delivery. Like, you have to train that. And I think it's funny because in the fitness space, we think about lifting and we're like, oh yeah, high volume for building muscle makes sense, because you do a lot of volume, you build a lot of muscle, then you have more muscle that can then be refined for strength and power output that you refine with like higher percent rep max work. We think about that logically, like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, I'll spend time doing a good bit of volume, but all the higher volume stuff's at lower intensity, because you can't do sets of 10 at 90% of your one rep max, right? So you have to pull back to like 60 or 70 or whatever that estimate would be. You're doing less effort, but you're doing it for more reps. You're accumulating volume. You're building muscle. You're building that like strength foundation bandwidth or whatever you want to call it. And then, okay, well, I'm going to peak and prep for something. So I'm going to start spending a lot of time lifting those high intensities. Oh, we're becoming more refined there. We're making progress. We're getting stronger. We have more muscle. I feel like the fitness industry accepts that. And they're like, yeah, okay, cool, great. But then when you think of cardio of the same thing, well, let's pull back to 60, 70% of our 100% effort and do that for a lot of volume. People are like, no, that's silly. I'm just going to train at 90% all the time. And you're like, well, that isn't going to, it's, yes, that's good, but it shouldn't be all you do. And I think a lot of people really, really want that black or white, all or nothing, only do this, don't do this type thing. And I think there's also again, a lot of the fitness industry stuff comes from like, what's the best for fat loss? And a lot of people push HIIT so much for that for the longest time. And it's like always the conversation of like, well, what's better, high intensity interval training or low intensity steady state, like, or moderate intensity continuous training? And like, there's always this argument of like, what's the best thing? Because we're always thinking about like, what's the, it's going to change our body the most, but we forget about the benefits of each of those in their own regard when we're actually trying to improve or refine physiology, especially for performance, right? So it's hard to get people to break away from this or that, or like one or the other type thing, because it's like it's sold one way in the fitness industry, but then they start to have performance goals or more specific goals. And you have to start thinking of things as like if and, or like, you know, this and that more than just only this, only intensity all the time. So yeah, there's so many perceptions, and whether that's coming from social contexts or just people feeling like they need to feel like their training's doing something for it to feel like it was worthwhile for them to do. And it's hard. I think this is the hardest part of coaching, is convincing people to do less. because sometimes, a lot of times you're convincing people to do more and push harder. There's two camps of people. Some people do need to do more and push harder, but the camp of people who needs to pull back and do less, I feel like are the hardest to convince, because they're not willing to take the chance to go long enough to find out that it's okay and you actually can make more progress there too.
When someone watching this who maybe isn't that bothered about performance at this stage, is just starting her fitness journey and it's much more about health, well-being and maybe longevity, you know, fit enough to keep up with the kids, but also the strength benefits for long-term health. What would a typical training week look like in terms of number of strength sessions, cardio work, plyometrics, other work? Could you give us an overview of what a typical week should look like? And as a follow-up question, how much would the prescription you give change for a 20-year-old woman versus a 40-year-old perimenopausal woman? Are there significant changes in that training regime?
Yeah. So before I kind of go into the description of the training regime, I'll answer that last question first before I go into it, because I think it will make more sense. And so, you know, there's a lot of trends right now about peri and postmenopausal training, and it's been fantastically sold as this magnificently totally different, everyone's hiding a lie from you, made up type of training. And it's really not that different. The difference is when you get to peri and postmenopause is that I like to describe it as you have less margin for error. The decline and shifting of your hormones does make it harder for things you might not be recovering as well. Your body is changing and shifting. You know, it's changing how it stores fat. It's less metabolically efficient to some degree, give or take your own personal, you know, body within that. And so it's not that what you need to be doing is any different, is that it becomes more important to be doing the things that you hopefully were doing in your 20s and 30s or 40s before you led into that transition. And so when I think about training for women, one, it's not also that different than good training for men. And people also hate when I say that, but it's like, you know, we're just pinkifying fitness for women nowadays. We're selling them heavy weights and high protein. And I'm like, how is that any different than what men are selling to other men? We're just making it sound more hormone friendly and sexy. And so when I think about training for women, we want to build muscle. We want to build as much muscle as we can while we can, when we can, no matter when we're starting, whether that's at 20 or that is at 40 or 50 years old. You want to build, maintain, or preserve muscle at any point in time. So a mix of, you know, hypertrophy work mixed with strength training, because we also want to use strength training. We want to maintain strength, power output, physical capacity as we age, especially as we age, that declines. We lose that as we lose estrogen. Our type 2 muscle fibers, the more powerful, more force outputting muscle fibers tend to lose their capacity. That also happens with aging itself. So there's kind of a double whammy there. But in your 20s and 30s, you should be thinking about building as much physical capacity as you can going into menopause. And then if you're going through that transition, thinking about preserving, maintaining, or building as much as you can as you're going through that. It does get harder, and I will acknowledge that, it does get harder. And so you want that strength and muscle building and power and quality effort focused within your training there. But also that's really important too, because it also helps with protecting bone health, either maintaining or preserving or gaining bone density. For the younger girls, you are still kind of in that phase of your life where you can really maximize that bone density growth. It's not impossible as you get older, but we kind of peak at that in the teens to 20s. So if you can build that while you're young, do it. But it doesn't mean all hope is lost as you get older. But you want to be loading your tissues with heavy weight, especially the hips and the spine, because that's where most of the bone density loss is occurring. In this population as we age, or we have most of the risk factors for fracture risk or osteoporosis as women age. So making sure like the heavy deadlifts or trap bar deadlifts or squats or leg presses or, you know, that kind of stuff is great for loading like that, the spine and hips of your body. And then from there, we can think about plyometrics or power-based training. That's also another great way to also maintain the quality and power output and integrity of our muscles and their performance and our independence within that, but also can contribute to maintaining or building or preserving bone density itself. You can start with just some hops, skipping, double leg hopping, low hops, low box hops to start, and then progress and make them more advanced as you go along. And so from a strength component perspective, I really like somewhere from at least 2 days a week of full body strength training. The exercise guidelines are 2 days a week of full body training. Generally, we want 60-ish minutes a week of strength training as a minimum, but any and all strength training you would do is better than nothing. Start with body weight, start with bands if you need to. Machines are okay to use. If you have the ability, you can either access it or you can use a gym or you can purchase it of heavy dumbbells or kettlebells or heavy weights in barbells or something similar. I encourage anyone who can access that and use it or do that to do that simply because that's how you're going to get a lot of load on your body. But if you can't or you're unwilling or you're unable to do that, body weight or resistance bands is fine to do. It's better than nothing. But with that, you might need to do like a lot more frequency and more volume because you have less load. But when you first get started out, that might be enough to just challenge you, and that's totally okay. But I like 2 full days a week thinking about full body. So when you think about full body, you want a movement that is a squat pattern. So bending at your knees, whether that's a squat or a leg press or a lunge or a step up, anything that's kind of a movement that requires you to bend at your knees is kind of a squat pattern that you can think of with that with people. And then a hinging pattern. So something like a deadlift, an RDL, maybe a hip thrust. I still like the picking stuff off the ground, though encouraging that to some degree. It can be with a trap bell, with a barbell, with a machine, with dumbbells, kettlebells, whatever that looks like for you. And then thinking about your upper body, pushing away from the chest, pushing overhead, and then pulling towards you, and then like core work. And if you pick an exercise that kind of challenges each of those parts of your bodies on 2 full body days a week, 2 to 3 sets, somewhere between. If you're doing strength work, I love like 3 to 6 reps for that, like the heavy strength work. And then everything else, I really like you can try to train in the range of 6 to 15 reps and kind of oscillate between that. And you want to make sure that you're lifting at a 7 to 8 out of 10 effort. Or if you went to total failure, you could only do maybe 1 to 4 more reps at the weight that you lifted at that day. For many people, this is hard. So, you know, checking in with yourself, actually learning what failure feels like to you, challenging yourself more. I really like to encourage people, if you don't need rest times and your reps don't slow down as you're doing them and they look the same speed as your first one and you're distracted while you're lifting, it's a good indication that you can add more weight. A lot of women underload because they're afraid of getting injured and fear around that. So they kind of underload a lot of the time. And I'd rather you do less higher loaded, more quality than just doing a bunch. So I like that for 2 to 3 days a week of full body lifting. I think for Gen Pop regular people, that's the sweet spot. If you really want a bodybuilding split that's 4 or 5 days a week, that's fine. But I think you can get a lot done with less within that and then make space for the cardio training in your life within that. I only lift 3 days a week. And I have only lifted 3 days a week for most of the last 8 years. And I think that that's like such a good sweet spot within that for a lot of people, whether that's hybrid training or lifestyle, because it makes space for the rest of it as well. Because the biggest thing with people like this is they have kids and they have families and they have obligations. They don't have time to spend 6 days a week in the gym unless you want to. Then, you know, that's fine. And if you really want the 4 days a week doing like an upper lower or push pull upper lower type split or like upper lower full, like just figuring that out, you can potentially do that. And I think that's fine for the lifting is, but really if at the least 2 to 3 days of full body, I think is great. They can be 30 to 60 minutes long. They don't need to be an hour long. They can be, kind of get it in, get it out, get it done, keep it quality. And then from a cardio training perspective, we want to meet the exercise guidelines again at a minimum, because that's what we know is like the minimum for health. And so that's 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous intensity activity, or 75 minutes of very vigorous physical activity. And so that can range for some people. Some people walking is enough. Some people it isn't. That's a big controversial thing right now. If walking is enough to stimulate you to do cardio, then do it. But the goal long term should be that a casual walk shouldn't be enough to like get your heart rate to above that point in time. But you want your heart rate to be at least 50 to 60% of your max heart rate, which a really quick, easy estimate for math for people. It's not perfect, but it's a little bit easy for most people. It's 220 minus your age, give or take 10 beats per minute. It can range for you, but that can be a good starting point of you saying, well, is my heart rate half of this at least when I'm doing my training? And that's kind of just a really loose, easy way to gauge. People are always like, why don't you use heart rate reserve? And I was like, the average person doesn't even want to understand how to calculate heart rate reserve. It's just easier to do this and then say it's not perfect. And if you have performance goals, we can figure out your true heart rate max. But for the lay person, it's probably close enough that if you're getting to 50% of that effort. So if you're 30 years old, 220 minus your age is 190. If you're getting to 50% of that at least in your training, then okay, that's probably enough for that for moderate to vigorous or whatever that is in your training. Or the higher intensity stuff of 75 minutes. So I think it's great to divide this across the week. getting in, I think we should get in a little bit of like either a walk or cardio most days of the week is probably good, just simply because to get that in. So 20 to 30 minutes at a time can be great, whether that's like a shorter HIIT session that is maybe that 15 minute range, or, you know, if it's a longer, easier session, 20 to 30 minutes is great, but it can be distributed out across your day in as small chunks as needed. It's all about getting it in and meeting yourself where you're at and then building from there. So that's kind of the minimum of where we want to at least be. And then from there, we can build. And so if you're kind of thinking about the minimum to moderate range of that, that's probably another 3 days a week, maybe two 30-minute days and one 60-minute day. Maybe that's like two to three 20, 30-minute sessions during the week, one longer session on the weekend. And it doesn't have to always be formal training. Go on a hike on the weekend with your kids or your family or your dog. Like, you know, you can, you know, go play, run around in the backyard with your dog or your kids, or, you know, go play pickup sports with your friends or your peers or things like that. Like, it doesn't have to be just milling away on something. But I do like thinking about if you're just going to do traditional gym-based fitness, one, maybe 2 days of like higher intensity stuff, and then the rest being lower to easy it or intensity stuff, whether that's walking to zone two or like even gardening or passive activity, like things like that, can sometimes count and contribute to that. So just being active as often as you can. And then, yeah, across the day, taking walk breaks, taking sitting breaks, you know, aiming for 7,000 to 8,000 steps per day, if you can hit that, is great. 10,000 doesn't have to be, more doesn't hurt, but that's a good place for just like thinking about breaking up your steps often is really underappreciated. Don't sit all day long. Try to be more generally active as you can. And especially if you don't have big performance goals, you're not pushing yourself to your max all the time. People, you know, don't worry about like how active you are. Be as active as you can. Like, don't worry about like, well, I need, someone on the internet said that I need 3 day rest days a week. Well, you probably need to be generally active most days of the week. And some days are a more specific exercise day. And some days are more of a, hey, I'm just like passive exercise type day kind of thing, right? And so I think people fearmonger people a lot of thinking that they're overdoing it. And if you're just like reaching the exercise guidelines and doing like a couple days of lifting and a couple bouts of cardio a week, you're probably not overdoing it. If you're not perfectly in zone two, you're not going to die. Just try to get in some sort of training, a little bit of easy stuff, a little bit of harder stuff. So, you know, an ideal week would be like 2 to 3 full body lifts, adding in some jumping, hopping, plyometrics on like 1 to 2 maybe of those days per week, building that up over time. That can be part of your lift. And then adding in maybe 3 days of some sort of formal or informal cardio per week, maybe 2 shorter days, 20 to 30 minutes long, one longer day, or you could do more short if you want to spread it out across the week like that. And just trying to hit those minimums, I think that's a great spot for most people where they're at to kind of get a lot of things they want to do. And then, you know, people like to do yoga or Pilates or group fitness or other things, like get the strength in and then figure out the intensity of the other things you're doing. But maybe you're just switching that in for some of your general activity. And that's fine to do too. When I don't list those things, people are like, well, I love to do all these other things too. And I'm like, that's great, do them. But like that contributes to your general overall activity. You still need a little bit of formal cardio. You still need a little bit of formal lifting. But if you're being very active across the board, like that's a great thing. That's not bad. Absolutely continue to add that in and fit it where you need to or can.
As a quick sidebar, how often are you still getting questions or resistance from women who don't want to lift heavy weights because they think it's going to make them bulky? Is that still something that happens on a regular basis, that misconception?
I think that I'm fortunate that my community isn't as much that type of mindset. But I do think that there has been this rise again recently. Pilates has gotten really trendy, and I have no issues with Pilates itself necessarily, but there's this big movement of being like long and lean and toned again, where they're saying you need like the light, low weight, high rep type stuff to build this long, lean toned look. And you don't want like people, a lot of women are saying they're intentionally not lifting heavy or lifting for gaining muscle because they don't want to be bulky or big. And I do think that there's a lot of the TikTok world, maybe more than my bubble on Instagram, that is kind of a thing that's coming back, which I think is kind of unfortunate. Because the reality is volume is really going to push that muscle growth. And if you don't want to be super muscular, like, because that's your personal choice, I do think we should all focus to gain some muscle because it's very metabolically protective and very important. And it makes me very scared that women are afraid to lift heavy to some degree because of bone and muscle retention. But, you know, heavy lifting at a lower volume but higher intensity is a great way to build strength and support your muscle health without having to be a bodybuilder in your type of training. Like, I don't think people realize that like you can train for strength and muscle growth in a way that isn't going to make you like the biggest, most bulkiest person on the planet because you do it. Because it's, again, a lot of misinformation that like, well, if you touch a weight, you're going to blow up. So I do think that there is that out there. I think I'm very fortunate that my community isn't the one having it. Every once in a while, I do get people who follow me and come to me simply because they know me in the female fit space, but they're like, but I hate lifting and I hate heavy lifting. And like, what should I do? And I'm like, the reality is like, you either don't do it and are okay with the repercussions of not doing it, or you just suck it up and do it because you know that it's important and good to do. Or, but what I usually encourage people in that boat is like, there's so many different ways to lift. Like, I think a lot of people think of lifting as just one way of doing lifting. But there, you can powerlift, you can Olympic weightlift, you can do CrossFit, you can do bodybuilding, you can do kettlebells, you can do just heavy dumbbells only. You can join a small group training strength class at your gym. Like, you can train for, you know, all these different ways of training for strength. I think people think like, well, you only get to be a bodybuilder or powerlifter, and those are the only options that I get. And that's not true. And for me personally, like, even in my strength approach, it's a little bit hybrid. I mix together kind of athletic general preparedness with bodybuilding and strength training activities, and it kind of gets a little bit of like the best components of all of these things. You get strength, power, and hypertrophy and athleticism all in one, and that supports all those health metrics too. And it doesn't need to be done at such a volume and intensity that you're blowing up and you're looking like the biggest, bulkiest elite male power lifter.
I think the other key concern or issue I hear around female training is faster training, or simply women being underfed, not taking on enough, specifically carbohydrates, not just before training and after training, but throughout the day. As you said before, diet culture, cutting carbs, trying to, you know, maximize fat loss by very low carb diets and a lot of high intensity training. Can you talk a little bit about low energy availability, some of the chronic and the acute symptoms, just because I think a lot of women watching this may not be aware that this is what they're suffering from.
Yeah. So I know a lot of people, when I talk about like a lot of these things, they think, well, this is always anti-changing your body and fat loss. And it's not that bad. It's that I think that the fitness industry gives you, if you're listening to this, really crummy information on how to go about it. And it's more harm than good. And this is a good example of that, is this low energy availability. And a lot of women are unaware of it because they think, well, I'm not an elite endurance athlete, I'm not losing my menstrual cycle, well, I'm not causing any harm to myself. But low energy availability is essentially when there's a mismatch between the energy you're expending through exercise and daily living and the intake that you're bringing in. And when you have a mismatch between these for a long period of time, your body downregulates bone production, muscle recovery, and or your health can decline because you can suppress thyroid hormone or female hormones, ovarian hormones, and have things that impact either your menstrual cycle can be disrupted, or loss of it eventually, we all know, is like amenorrhea, but it can be impacting you before you lose your menstrual cycle. And I don't think people kind of realize that, but if you do not have a menstrual cycle or it is having irregularities, like, that's something to definitely look into with a medical provider. But it's when this is done chronically is when it becomes an issue. But people don't realize that it's not just chronic long-term undereating. It can also be day-to-day eating or acute periods of time. And so females are more sensitive to energy deficit than males. So this, the threshold of which energy availability occurs in women occurs at a higher caloric intake than males. So males can dig deeper or eat less or be less well-fed, and not have this hormonal or downregulation or physiological impact as women. Simply, our thresholds are higher, but it technically, like, what I'm saying is, like, we have less room for that. Like, it's like 40 to 45 grams per calories per gram of fat-free mass a day, where men, it's like in the 30s where they can dig into before it starts to impact them. So we just have less room for error for how deep we can dig in, like, energy deficits chronically for this, especially when we are high training. And so if you're generally physically active, you're training a lot of intensity. I think there's a lot of gen pop women who do a lot of high intensity stuff 5-6 days a week, but they don't consider themselves an athlete, and they're always eating like they're dieting, and they're like, well, I'm just doing general fitness, this doesn't apply to me. And I'm like, well, you're doing like 6 to 7 hours a week of activity, and a lot of it's moderate to high intensity. So, like, yeah, it does apply to you. And so when this happens, it's not just this long-term under-eating, but it also can be triggered by, or we can get symptoms from it, from under-eating carbohydrates. So there's some similarities and overlaps we're starting to see in the data now of being, like, under-carbohydrate fed elicits similar issues that we're seeing with low energy availability, because you don't have that carbohydrate that you need to support your training and fuel it appropriately. And it can also be triggered by or impacted by, like, acute intraday energy deficit. So if you're not eating for half the day, or you're not eating before or after training, or you're in an energy deficit because you live off coffee and a whiff of air in the morning and then a salad with, like, nothing on it at lunch, then you get home at night and you're overeating, or you're eating a lot of calories, or you're eating a lot on the weekends. Yes, your overall energy balance might be adequate or high. Like, cause I think a lot of people, they're like, well, I'm not losing weight, or I'm gaining weight, or I'm overweight, or, you know, my body's not changing, so I'm not under eating. But then they're in an energy deficit for a part of the day. Just because you're eating enough overall doesn't mean that you might not be in an energy deficit for part of the day. And so, you know, people get a lot of flack for the fasted training thing. And so my approach is, yes, there's some data on fasted training in women that shows it might improve body composition measures in people who are potentially like overweight or have excess body fatness, however you want to describe it based off classifications in the literature. It may improve hormone profiles in those individuals simply because fat loss can sometimes, you know, improve health outcomes and physiology and how it interacts. But if I, you know, we also have a lot of like risk with that when we're thinking about people who are moderately to highly active, or especially very active, where you need energy to fuel the activity that you're doing, and being in that energy deficit is just going to add additional stress to our bodies and make it harder to recover or adapt from, or simply then kind of keep our hormones in check while we're also doing that. So a lot of intensity and volume and high training gets a lot of bad flack because they're like, well, it's raising your cortisol and it's overly stressful and it's making you gain fat, which is a silly claim, or it's destroying your hormones. But really, it's this lack of appropriate food versus intensity and volume of what you're doing. And so I generally recommend to not do fasted training. One, the data for fasted training for fat loss, I mean, you can do it, but it's not like, it's not something that's like this pincetta of like amazing results. It's like an argument of like a few grams of fat oxidation that maybe bodybuilders at the peak of their prep might care about, but the average person might not. And it might help, you know, decrease overall daily calories. And that might be true for some people. And so my approach is, if you really, really want to do fasting, especially if you're a woman, you know, there is some data to suggest that just terminating feeding earlier in the day, so after dinner or eating an earlier dinner, might be good for metabolic health, simply because we have potentially less insulin sensitivity and declined fat oxidation later half of the day. So if you're really dead set on doing some sort of fasting, maybe just stop eating after dinner, I think, or eat an earlier dinner or something like that. But if you're going to do morning training, or you're going to be more active, you need carbs and protein available in your body. So I really encourage you to eat not just before training, even if it's just a little bit of carbohydrate. People are resistant to that because they're just like, well, I get up in the morning and I train right away. And like, you can get in some graham crackers or some juice or some chocolate milk or some applesauce packets. Like, I've ran every day this week at 6 a.m. and I've gotten like 30 grams before and then probably 30 to 70 grams in during, just as a way to kind of keep that going. But it doesn't need to be a full meal. But I really do encourage you to do some fed training. And or prioritize getting in like a well-balanced meal for breakfast and lunch. Like, don't do this thing where you're living off coffee. Coffee isn't a meal, especially if you have high activity levels. You need to be fed frequently across the day. You don't want to go through these bouts of time where you have this low energy availability during the day, even if you are eating enough calories across the day. And I know it can be hard, but it's definitely something that you want to prioritize if you do care about hormonal health and you are more active. I would say, people who are less active, more in that lower end of the energy spectrum, yeah, it's not good to not eat for a whole bunch of time across the day, but you're probably going to be a little bit less sensitive to that simply because you're not expending such a high flux of energy. And so, yeah, some people might get away with it and they're like, well, I feel fine and I feel great and I feel good if I do this. And I'm like, well, you also want to think about, are you protecting your muscle and your health within that? And are we just going to, you know, are we giving our body the carbs and amino acids that it needs to help preserve these things? It's a really like a disclaimer filled take on it because I know people don't like it. My general advice is, if you're moderate to highly active, don't do it. Everyone else, use it at your own discretion.
You think the resistance comes from that pervasive diet culture where people are in the, specifically we were in the mindset of, hang on, I'm doing this to burn calories. Why on earth would I be taking any on? There's that counterproductive argument.
Yeah, it seems counter. And you know, you can explain it up and down, left and right, and people still are like, well, it doesn't make sense because bringing it in. But they don't realize that if you're fed, you can usually do more total work. So you're expending more energy. And two, yes, in certain types of exercise, you might be burning more fat, like lower intensity exercise, you burn more fat, but you're also burning less total calories. But if you worked at a higher intensity, you are burning more total calories. And, you know, there's pros and cons to that within that. And I think people training only for fat burning is also flawed in itself. But three, people forget improving your overall fitness status or increasing your aerobic fitness status itself is associated with being better at using, burning, and oxidizing fat across the day, both during exercise in response to the meals you eat and in general. So people are too worried about what their actual exercise training is doing in the moment and forgetting that improving that aerobic fitness status itself is contributing to your better fat burner if you are more fit, basically. And so they think about that acute effect of like, oh, okay, well, I'm burning more fat in the moment, but our bodies also have this crossover where you might burn more fat during that training session. But then once you eat, it's going to switch to oxidizing and burning carb immediately after or the rest of the day once that carbohydrate is available, because your body will kind of ebb and flow through these states of lipid and fat carb oxidation across the day. So it's not as simple as like, well, you're burning more fat now, but you might be burning less fat later because you have a carbohydrate available versus, okay, maybe I'm burning more carbs now, but then my recovery, I'm burning more fat. And so it's not as cut dry as burn more fat. And then that fat immediately is directly related to fat loss. Well, you're oxidizing fat on and off across the day. And it's about that net balance of that fat that is contributing to fat loss. And it's not just only from your exercise training. So there might be some benefit to increasing fat mobilization and burning. And there's some signs to that. And a lot of it's more in like overweight or obese type populations or those with extra adiposity. And there might be merit there because there's less resistance to fat mobilizing out of cells and sensitivity of the adipose tissue and blah, 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 blah. But I still think that my recommendation and my bias here is that you should be more focused on just increasing or improving cardiovascular fitness or how much cardio or movement you're doing across the day, because that itself will improve that, than worrying about like, oh, okay, I burned like 6 grams more of fat during this training session. Because I did fasted HIIT as part of my dissertation study. And in all these exercise protocols, that they're still using a ton of carbs. And the difference in fat oxidation is, it's not as much as people think it is. It's very trivial how many grams. It's like, oh, you might be burning 9 grams of fat total in this whole session. And that's really not that much at the end of the day.
And what about optimal protein intake? Because I think that's another area where women will kind of shy away from protein. Again, please appreciate I'm speaking in very generalistic terms here, and it's just to try and get the point across. But what about protein intake? How much do women need for optimal health? And again, does that change as women approach their 40s and beyond?
So as women go through menopause, peri, and post, I do think the intake of protein becomes more important, or more like you really want to keep that protein intake moderate to high. It might be harder, especially because if you're, you know, as you age, you might be less active, so you might be eating less calories. So your protein then is overtaking so many of your calories. And I think that's where a lot of that resistance and difficulty comes from. But, you know, that protein intake is really, really important for preserving metabolic health and function. And there's even some like early data suggesting that, you know, because we're under eating protein, we're overeating during this phase of life because your body's wanting to bring in those amino acids, but indirectly you're bringing in extra carbs and fats and calories, but you're not eating that protein need. And that sometimes eating that adequate amount of protein will help with maintaining and preserving the muscle loss that we see with peri and postmenopause because of loss of estrogen. But also then you maintain that muscle, so then you're maintaining more metabolic function and more metabolic sensitivity. So you're less likely to have, you know, that contribution of muscle loss resulting in insulin sensitivity and downstream negative metabolic health effects because you have that protein intake, and that's helping with exercise recovery and repair. And if you have a harder time with maintaining exercise intensity because you're not recovering as well, that can help with that as well. And that also might help with some of the food cravings and or appetite issues that you might feel that you're doing at that. And then because of all these things, you might have an easier time maintaining more activity or regulating your hunger and satiety a little bit better within that. And so, yes, I recommend moderate to high protein intake for most women across the entire lifespan. But here, I think it's like really important to making sure that you're getting your protein in across the day, all day long, because there's also the compound of aging where we see a lot of these issues that are also exacerbated by aging. Women might not need as high as like, you know, the classic 1 gram per pound of body weight per day or 2.2 per kilo. You know, we might tinker out about 1.6 to 1.7 grams per kilogram per day. So maybe like that 0.7 to 0.8 kind of thing. I think it's good to think about, you know, eating at least your body weight of lean mass in grams, but a lot of people don't know their lean mass kind of thing. So that's harder. So these equations are great places to start. But if you are someone who has more body fatness, you might be on the lower end of these things because you don't need to eat a gram per pound of your body fat as well. You can think about more, that's where lean mass can be more helpful. But you know, those are the kind of the rough ranges. So that 1.6 to 1.8 grams per kilogram of body weight per day, or the 0.7 to 0.8 grams per pound of body weight per day, give or take. It doesn't hurt to eat up to 1 gram per pound of body weight or 2 per kilo. But it might just not be like super necessary. But as we go through menopause and perimenopause, we want to kind of err on the higher end of those things if we can, simply for maintaining all this metabolic function. So eating more if you weren't eating high before is a better way of putting it. But it's good and important to do that across the day, even in the premenopausal state, kind of similar recommendations there that I was stating before. The more active you are, the more protein you're probably going to need. I think for most women, an easy recommendation is eating at least 100 grams per day, like 100 to 120, unless you're really, really, really petite, is kind of a good rough estimate. If you can't get to that range, getting closer to 80 to 90. And again, I'm just rough balling because I know people want specific prescriptions. Again, a lot of it just depends on muscle mass and activity level and body size. But those are kind of more like, I think that goes around a lot of people being like, eating at least 100 grams per day is trendy right now, but it's not a terrible trend, or getting it at least 30 grams per meal and then having some snacks. I think that's great. Don't be afraid to supplement with shakes if you need to. Plant-based and animal-based are both perfectly fine to help supplement that in. And I think the biggest thing for this is what's hard for people is they're always looking for like snacks or fillers or easy ways to do it. Start thinking about building protein forward meals, like having like a protein component of your meal. Well, if you eat meat or animal based, you know, having some sort of like lean meat or meat based product leading your meal that you're eating. And if you're not, you know, really looking into how to maximize plant protein pairings so that you're building your meals around like protein pairs that give you complete amino acids, or having, you know, your tofu or your tempeh or whatever it is that you focus on and emphasize in that meal, and then maybe having to supplement a little bit more because it is harder to get that in that population, which again, as long as you're eating enough amino acids plant-based, it's also appears to be perfectly fine. But I think that a lot of women struggle with protein intake. I struggle. I am like the queen of preaching protein to people, and I even struggle with getting in enough protein intake per day. I don't eat 1 gram per pound of body weight because it's hard for me to do. I mean, some days I hit it, but I really try to get at least 1 gram per pound of lean mass, if not a little bit higher of that. But I'm still getting, I'm like 142 pounds. I probably get in between 115 and 130 grams per day. And that's still like pretty good. And I don't feel like I lose muscle. I recover fine. And sometimes I supplement if I need to, sometimes I'm doing it with just meat. That's totally okay. So I give that as like the disclaimer of people of like, you know, I'm not even eating 1 gram per pound per day because I find it hard for me to do, where there's other people who are like, I can eat 200 grams a day. That's no problem whatsoever. And it's really about figuring out like what works for you. For me, prepping the food is more of the issue of why I don't get it in than like all these other things. But for some people, it's appetite or preference. So just thinking about building those meals with the emphasis and focus on that. But it's okay to supplement 20 to 30 grams of protein per day if you need to get that extra bump for what you need.
Final question. Can you give me an update on kind of the state of play of exercise physiology research? Because a criticism for so long has been so much of the research has been done on men for a number of reasons, that doing the same equivalent studies on women is difficult for hormonal reasons, menstrual cycle, whatever. It's expensive. It takes longer. Is the sex gap in the research closing, widening? Can you give us an update on how you're feeling, positive or negative, about the future of research in this area?
So our group, we actually published a paper on this in 2021 called Invisible Sportswomen, and it essentially was a follow-up to the same exact style paper done like 5 years prior, looking at the 5 biggest journals in sport and exercise science and looking at the ratio of male versus female participants. And it didn't change since the prior study that was done 5 years prior. So that's like spanning 10 years. It looks about like 34% of total participants are women, and 66% of studies are done specifically on women specific questions. So like, that's kind of what we found there, give or take a percentage or two, I might be off. But, you know, our group then followed up on a next study looking at the quality of the studies and finding that there's a relationship between, like, you know, the women leading studies or being the main scientist on studies or on editorial boards are accepting or publishing papers that are of higher quality related to this work. Because the issue is not even just the rate of this work being done, but a quality control issue, because measuring and assessing and managing for the menstrual cycle can be quite difficult. And so it's about striking the balance between those two that's been hard, but does require funding and time and interest. And it does appear that women are the ones interested in leading this work. And so we obviously, that was a few years ago now, and there's been this big push, I think, in the field for more quality work, more papers, more like assessment of this. And I do think that there is a shift going towards it, but I, you know, research is slow. And so it's probably going to be another 10 years before we start to see a lot of the accumulation of the impact of this data coming out in the field. There's a lot of great scientists who are really leading this work and doing a great job with this. And so I think that it's going to get better, and it's getting better, and there's a push, but I think that there is not an appreciation for how slow that takes and the efforts that are being made by like the fitness industry or the lay public, because they're always criticizing it. I'm like, this is really hard work to do, and it does take a long time. There are a lot of people who are working really hard to make it better. And what I also like to point out is that just because there's less research doesn't mean there's none. We do need more, but doesn't mean there's none. And I think people kind of use it sometimes as an excuse to just like make up exercise application for what we should do for women. And we're just using hypothesis or like, you know, just anecdotal stuff as how to do it. And like, I think good coaching is a blend of science and practical application. And of course, working the person at hand in front of you. But I think, you know, people think that that means there's no data on women at all. There's nothing that we know. Everything's, we know nothing. And I think it's just like a lack of understanding how research and science works in the state of exercise science as a whole. So yes, there's less, but that doesn't mean there's none. But we do need more. And mostly what we need is it to be better. And we need better quality control of the menstrual cycle, or just reporting of it in general, so we can make better assessments of things. Because right now with the data we do have, it's really messy, right? And the patterns are very inconsistent because we have really different ways of controlling and regulating and reporting the menstrual cycle. And so I think that's the biggest thing where people are really trying to push for improved quality.
Is there also the issue that the women-specific considerations that don't apply to men around, you know, the sex differences, the hormones, the menstrual cycle, it all gets kind of thrown into one bucket. But they're obviously very, very different things. Sex differences are, that should be taken in isolation, and then the menstrual cycle should be taken in isolation. Yes. Is that a common problem, that they are just all jumbled?
I think that not really. I don't see this as much of an issue in exercise science, but I see this in the fitness industry where people don't understand that. You know, when I say that the data doesn't suggest that there's these magnificent differences in how we should train and approach the menstrual cycle, people are like, you hate women and you think we're just like men. And I was like, no, because sex differences are not, menstrual cycle differences are not the same as sex differences, right? Like that isn't, yes, like our female hormones and menstrual cycle are a component of our biological sex, but that's not the only thing that contributes to our training and adaptations and all that stuff. So it's like the conversation is sex differences and then menstrual cycle impact or differences. And I think a lot of people group those together. And I get why, because they're like, well, women have menstrual cycles and they have these hormone fluctuations. And you're like, yes, that's true. That's a piece of it. But there's also just going to be these foundational biological differences between us that are true irregardless of that fluctuation across the month. So just because we don't have data to suggest right now this is as robustly different as people are painting it out to be on the internet doesn't mean that we are identical exactly to males, but also we are the same species. We adapt to exercise training and stimulus. We appear to adapt similarly to training. We respond to cardio. We respond to lifting. I think people think it's as if that we like respond totally differently and we need these completely different exercise protocols. And it's like, we're hiding the secret of how to train women. And we're like, but we're not. It's just like there's going to be potentially slight tweaks in what we do, but it's not going to be totally different. It's like with all thing exercise, you're tweaking and adjusting the same components of training. And that's where we need to be thinking about. People are looking for, like, same with the menopause and the menstrual cycle and all this stuff. They're looking for these like completely different exercise training protocols. I'm like, there's only so many variables like that you can do and manipulate and control. It's just about figuring out where we have to turn those dials for what we need to do. But we're not reinventing the wheel here. We're just adjusting it appropriately to whatever population that we're dealing with.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.